my favorite room. Because
it's... there are birds hanging from the ceiling.
So yeah, you walk in and there's bird mounts. And then there's some birds hanging from the ceiling. Some skeletons and skins, which are pretty awesome.
Awesome. It's fascinating. It sparks curiosity, and it's the reason most of us are alive today. But sometimes it sucks, from applying to funding to spending hours in the lab to lack of representation in many science fields. On this podcast, we talk about the ins and outs of scientific research and how it impacts our lives. Welcome to Science Sucks. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 22 of the pod. I'm Evie, neuroscientist, science communicator, a cat and dog person, and host of the Science Sucks radio show and podcast. Welcome to the show. This week, we step into the Royal Ontario Museum, aka the ROM, to talk to Talia Merritt Lowy, a PhD student whose office is right in the museum. And if you stay till the end, you'll get a super duper secret exclusive, never before seen by the general public, tour of the ROM's bird archives. That's right, we go behind the scenes for this episode. It's like Night at the Museum, but less Ben Stiller and more paperwork. Classic museum stuff. Now, before we meet Talia, let's give a little rundown of the ROM. This fine establishment is the largest and most visited museum in Canada, with over 1 million visitors every single year. The ROM first opened its doors in 1914, and it's since had a lot of cool expansions and additions, the coolest one of which is the Michael Leachin crystal that opened in 2007. If you don't know the ROM, you really gotta Google it to see this crystal. It's a pretty controversial piece of architecture. It pretty much looks like a UFO landed on top of Toronto's fanciest museum. One more super duper fun fact about the ROM is that I, yours truly, am a volunteer there. That's right, I have been spending one day a week in the galleries telling kids about birds, butterflies, and all of nature's wonders. I'm in the Shad Biodiversity Gallery, which is also called Life in Crisis. It shows animals from around the world and sheds light on conservation efforts, as well as some extinct or endangered species. The gallery opened in 2009, but wow, it is so much more powerful in 2019, with the Amazon literally being burned for profit and a climate crisis on our hands. I love galleries like Shad because it brings guests face to face with animals that we've lost and might lose in our future. So volunteering at the museum is great, and that's how Talia started out at the ROM as well. She was a volunteer, and now she's studying her PhD there. She is exploring the transition from dinosaurs to birds and the evolution of flight. So if you've ever wondered, how did birds learn to fly, and are they really dinosaurs? We explore that in this episode. The way this episode worked is first we went into her office and we chatted for the interview, and then we went on a tour of the archive. Since this is a podcast and you can't see the artifacts themselves, I've included pictures in the show notes so you can open the pictures and follow along while you listen so you know what we're talking about. So without further ado, here is Talia.
So I'm Talia and I'm a PhD student at the Royal Ontario Museum in the University of Toronto. I'm in the second year of my PhD. I've always been a little bit of a science person, or a lot of a science person. I grew up going to the Science Center and the ROM as a kid. I would have memberships there. I would go to their day camps. I was always playing outside, playing with toy animals and stuff like that. I didn't grow up thinking that I was going to do this specifically. You know, you hear a lot about people who, love dinosaurs as kids and then end up studying dinosaurs as adults, and that's not what's happening. But I am studying paleontology and ornithology now.
Paleontology means studying fossils to understand organisms that lived long ago. Ornithology is a study of birds. Talia studies fossils and bones of modern birds to understand how we got from dinosaurs to the robin in your backyard.
I knew I was going to go into life science in high school. And then when I got to undergrad, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I think I always knew that I wanted to do research, but I didn't know how to articulate that. I just knew that I didn't want to be a doctor, but I wanted to study life science. And then I took a couple courses in my undergrad that just led me into this ecology and evolutionary biology major, which I thought were so interesting. So one of them that really pulled me in was called macroevolution. And that was, you know, about, it would teach you about building phylogenetic trees and looking at the evolutionary history of life and major transitions in evolution, and I just thought it was so fascinating, especially the transition from dinosaurs into birds, which is actually what I'm studying now, which is really exciting. I also started volunteering at the ROM when I was in my undergrad, and that really pulled me into the world of museums and the world of science communication and the kind of research that goes on with scientific collections that we have here. So I was volunteering in the hands-on galleries, which, as you know, you get to interact with the public about the things that we have in our galleries and biodiversity and extinction and the kind of research that goes on here. And it was just really fun to be immersed in that and to talk to other people about it. And I knew that I wanted to continue to contribute to that knowledge base and continue communicating it to other people. I'm co-supervised by the paleontology curator, David Evans, and the ornithology curator, Santiago Claremont. And so I study, my major question of my research is the evolution of dinosaurs into birds and how birds acquired flight. So birds are Maniraptor and theropods, which are a kind of dinosaur. I know this feeds into another question you have later, but they're in a group called Paravians. So a group of dinosaurs that are related to Tyrannosaurus rex and raptors. Birds are part of that group. And we know that connection, but we don't have a clear understanding of how flight was acquired. So part of my research contributes to that. So I'm looking at how some shapes of the bones, specifically the sternum, so the breastbone, is related to different flight styles in modern birds, and how we can later apply that to the fossil record. So I started as an undergrad. I was doing undergrad research here with my paleontology supervisor, David Evans, and so I did an undergrad research project on some dinosaur skulls, on hadrosaurs, if anyone's ever heard of a hadrosaur before. They're the plant-eating duck-billed dinosaurs. They're the ones that we find most in Canada, mm-hmm. So in Alberta, which is where we find most of the dinosaur fossils here. I did some analysis on the shapes of skulls and what that can tell us about whether things are two different species or if one is a juvenile of the other one. And so that's what I did for my undergrad project, and I learned a ton. It was hard work, but it was really rewarding because it ended up going really well. I won some awards for my project. So I thought, okay, I really like research. I really want to go forward in this, but I also want to be studying birds because I also really like birds.
Yeah. Yeah, are you a fan of like birding and looking at birds around the city?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert birder. I always say, I do like to go birding, yeah. And I always say that it's best to go birding with someone who knows more than you. So if I go alone, like sometimes I'll be out for a walk and I'll see a bird. I'm like, oh yeah, I know what that is. But I'm definitely not like well-versed in all of the migrants that stop over, yeah. And then leave at the end of the spring migration. So it's really rewarding to go birding with someone who is more, yeah. Of an expert than you are. So right now is spring migration, or we're kind of on the tail end of it. And there were a couple times when we, around here in ornithology, Mark Peck, who's the ornithology technician, would take some people out to go birding in Queen's Park in the middle of Toronto, which is just like a few steps away from the ROM, and we would see a bunch of birds.
Talia mentioned it's migration season. We recorded this back in June, which was at the tail end of the huge May migration that happens here in southern Ontario. Birds from the US, Mexico, and even Central and South America fly north for the summer, so you can see gorgeous species, even in a city like Toronto. With my next question, I had to get to the real tea. Are birds dinosaurs? How did that happen? And how do they evolve flight? Let's hear what Talia has to say.
Yeah, so we have a lot of evidence that birds are dinosaurs based on a number of transitional fossils, the most famous one being Archaeopteryx, which is known as a mosaic of bird-like traits and dinosaur or reptile-like traits. So the bird-like traits are that it has these long asymmetrical feathers, which are known as flight feathers or pinnaceous feathers. There are different kinds of feathers. So there's the long asymmetrical ones, which are used in powered flight, which are on the wings mm-hmm. of birds. And then they can have the downy feathers, which are just kind of fuzzy and don't do much for flight, but just cover the rest of the body. And that's what baby birds or chicks are covered mm-hmm. in. And so you have a number of fossils that seem to have that filamentous downy feathers on them, but Archaeopteryx has those flight feathers. A number of them have this half moon shaped wrist bone or carpal bone, which in modern birds is known to be used in like the wrist folding action of flapping flight. Mm-hmm. But in fossils, like in raptors, the hypothesis is that that wrist bone is used for like snatching prey with their forelimbs. So that's why the word raptor means thief, basically. Mm-hmm. And a couple other things, they have fused clavicles. So if you've ever eaten a chicken and there's the thing called the wishbone. Mm-hmm. So those are the clavicle bones, and it's called a furcula in birds, and they're fused in the middle. And some theropod dinosaurs have those. Mm-hmm. So the raptors have those. And so those kind of clues are the things that tell us that birds evolved from dinosaurs. Yeah. And then also Archaeopteryx has teeth in its mouth, which modern birds don't have. And it has a long bony tail, which modern birds don't have. So it's got a mix of both of those traits. We don't just have Archaeopteryx. There are several other fossils, especially found in China, that are feathered dinosaurs and fossil birds. Some of them do really weird things. There are a number of dinosaurs that are thought to have bat wings.
Yeah.
So they're not pterosaurs, they're not pterodactyls, but they're like raptor dinosaurs, or they're related to raptor dinosaurs, and they have bat wings.
So not feathered wings.
Not feathered wings. These elongated fingers with skin attaching them together. Yeah, so there's a lot of variation in the fossil record. And so there have been a number of studies on the shapes of the wings that can show how things might have flown. So there have been a couple of hypotheses. The two main hypotheses on how flight was acquired, one is the arboreal or trees down hypothesis, in which birds are living up in trees and then gliding down from treetops onto the ground, and then later evolved the ability to flap and then would fly. And then the alternative hypothesis is the cursorial or ground up hypothesis, where they were living on the ground and then flapping on the ground and then eventually learned how to fly from that. So there are two camps. Neither of them have, you know, been able to confidently say we are the true scheme in which birds evolved flight, mm-hmm. And most of them focus on the wings. So I'm focusing on the sternum, which is a really major element in birds. Maybe I'll show you one.
Yeah.
So I have a skeleton of an owl here, and in the center of the body, so basically where the ribs attach in front, so if you kind of like feel the middle of your chest, your ribs have to attach to something.
Yeah.
And that's the sternum. So we have a sternum too. Most animals have a sternum. In birds, it's really big, and it has this projection in the middle, and that's called a keel. And that's where the flight muscles attach to.
Interesting.
Right? So the major flight muscles, the downstroke muscle, is called the pectoralis, and that's the big one because it needs more force to power its downstroke. And then the upstroke muscle is called the supracoracoideus, and both of those attach here onto the keel. And then you've got these other processes on the back of the sternum where some other muscles attach, like the like some abdominal muscles and stuff like that. So it's a pretty important element in flight, but not many people have studied it. So that's what I'm doing. I'm looking at how the differences in the shape of the sternum in different birds relate to how they fly.
That's
so birds can fly in different ways. Some soar, some flap, continuously. Some dive underwater with their wings. And so I think that there's some sort of relationship between that.
Yeah.
So I'm testing it and we'll see.
Yeah. Because I'm picturing like people going to the gym and they're working out their, you know,
their
chest
pecs,
muscles.
Yeah.
exactly. But if you're flying and hoisting your entire body weight up by your, I guess, arms, you would have to have very strong chest muscles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just showed you the owl. I also have a duck and a cuckoo here. So the shape is pretty different in these three different, very different birds, distantly related birds that fly in very different ways.
What was this one again?
This is called a yellow-billed cuckoo.
Cool.
And this one is some sort of duck.
Yeah, it looks like a duck.
And then this one's a long-eared owl.
Cool.
So yeah, look at the sternum.
I didn't know owls had such long legs.
Maybe yeah.
It's all bent over.
So, yeah.
They look very...
Most birds have longer legs than people expect, honestly.
True.
Yeah.
Because of...
They're covered in feathers.
Yeah. This might be a silly question, but reptiles are cold-blooded. Mm-hmm. Are birds cold-blooded as well?
No, that's a really good question. Birds are warm-blooded. And the very, very old way of thinking, like hundreds of years ago... Yeah. People used to think that birds and mammals were more closely related to each other. And they're not, because birds are reptiles. They evolved from dinosaurs, or they are dinosaurs, if that's how you want to say it. And that's the way they group, for people to group birds and mammals together just based on the fact that they're warm-blooded is something called a paraphyletic group.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a phylogeneticist, and you want to talk about groupings, what you want are monophyletic groups. And those groups are things that involve an ancestor and all of its descendants. So that's a group that actually makes sense. If you try to group things that don't have a common ancestor, or they do, but you don't include all of the descendants in between, like birds and mammals, then you're creating artificial groupings. Mm-hmm. And that's... That doesn't make any sense if you're trying to do any sort of scientific analysis or phylogenetic analysis. So people used to think that, but we have overwhelming evidence now that birds are dinosaurs and reptiles.
Yeah, I mean, even their beaks, they look a little bit like reptile beaks. Not beaks, but like the pointy mouths.
Absolutely, yeah. They're not anything like mammals.
That's so interesting. I think, yeah, it would be like one branch on the... quote-unquote family tree, evolutionary tree.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really cool. That explains a lot. So birds can, like, create their own body heat and stay warm.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Exactly.
And mammals evolve that, too.
Yeah, there's... So when two groups that are not sister groups evolve the same trait, that's called convergent evolution. So the trait of warm-bloodedness evolved twice, once in birds and once in mammals. And another really good example is flight. Powered flight evolved multiple times. So powered flight evolved in insects, and it also evolved independently in birds and in pterosaurs, which are pterodactyls, which are actually not dinosaurs. I'm not sure everybody knows that.
Pterodactyls aren't dinosaurs.
They're not. No, they are they're close to dinosaurs. They're in the same group. There's a group that encompasses dinosaurs, birds, crocodiles, and pterosaurs. That group is called Archosauria. And so pterosaurs are in that, but they are not dinosaurs. So they evolved flight independently. And also bats evolved flight independently. So we've got flight in multiple groups that evolved in different ways using slightly different structures.
Okay, so this blew my freaking mind. I'm editing the pod and still getting chills listening back to it. Evolution is the single coolest thing about our entire existence. Next, I had to ask Talia, what's it like working at a museum?
I have this beautiful office.
Yes.
I think it's just like any other place of work where you work in an office. Everyone in the Department of Natural History is kind of a community, which is nice. Just yesterday we had this, we had a talk series, which we do every month, called the ROM Incubator. And I actually gave a talk yesterday about my research. And it's really cool that we all get to kind of interact with each other and talk to each other about our research, and we all kind of study different things. So in Department of Natural History, we have ornithology and paleontology, or vertebrate paleontology. There's also invertebrate paleontology, which are people that study invertebrates, so things that don't have a backbone. And there's also invertebrate zoology, and so that lab mostly studies leeches, and they're awesome. They do mostly phylogenetic work. There are some fungi people, there are some geology people, so it's all over, and it's really interesting to hear about the different kinds of work that everyone's doing. We are pretty disconnected from the front of house galleries, but some people around here do work on some outreach things. Once in a while, we get asked to do stuff out in the galleries, like Friday Night Live and stuff like that. There's a Fossil Fest every once in a while, which is like a family day where we all have a table, have our own table, and we talk about different fossils from our collections. So yeah, cool. It's kind of like any grad school experience, yeah. But there's that extra element of the museum side, which is really fun. Yeah.
You're attached to like a pretty cool place.
Mm-hmm. And we're not too far from campus. So if we have to go to an event on campus, walk 15 minutes. Some of us are lazy and don't want to go sometimes, especially when it's winter and it's cold. But yeah. It's pretty nice over here.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine the first year maybe you had some classes to attend there. Mm-hmm. And then as you continue, like fewer classes.
Exactly. And like we have to TA on campus sometimes and stuff. So, you know, you can go back and forth.
Yeah, cool. Are there any I'm going to say that again. Are there any myths or misconceptions you want to debunk about what you study?
Yeah, so this isn't really a myth so much as a reminder that I want people, members of the public, to remember and may not realize, is that understanding the history of the world, understanding natural history, is fundamental to understanding our Earth today and the state of biodiversity. So as you probably say a lot when you're doing outreach in the museum, the past is the key to the present. And you can get a lot of skeptical people saying that paleontology isn't important. It's not, you're not doing direct conservation, you're not changing policies. But something that my supervisor actually told me yesterday, which I thought was really special and that I wanted to say here, was that we may not be writing specific policies on conservation, but we are creating knowledge that's fundamental to allowing people to digest and understand the implications of climate change and biodiversity loss that is happening now. So, for example, no one understands mass extinctions better than a paleontologist, yeah. Right? We look at, we work on stuff that is thousands to millions of years old, and we learn about the big five extinctions, and we are currently in the midst of the sixth mass extinction.
If you're like, wait, what? Five mass extinctions? Six? Well, here's the rundown. The fossil record shows five times in Earth's history when a large portion of life died out. The first mass extinction killed 86% of species on Earth. It was most likely caused by sea level drop and a short, severe ice age. The second extinction killed a whopping 75% of species, killing off the trilobites, which were at the time the most diverse animals that roamed the Earth. The third mass extinction, also known as the Great Dying, is by far the worst extinction the Earth has ever seen. It nearly ended life on Earth for good. 96% of species were lost during this extinction period. And there was a fourth mass extinction, which killed 80% of species. And the fifth one is the one that most of us know, the extinction of most dinosaurs. That was caused by volcanic activity, climate change, and most likely an asteroid that hit the Earth. Now, the sixth mass extinction is happening right now. It's also known as the Anthropocene, and it is caused by us, humans.
I think it's really useful to understand
natural
history.
Yeah.
And it's really useful to have collections in a museum and to educate the public. And so I don't know if I would call that a myth or a misconception, but I think it's a reminder that some people need if they are unaware of it.
Yeah, a lot of people are like, paleontology, dinosaurs aren't important today.
Yeah.
End of story. But that's not the end of the story. It's really important to understand that.
Absolutely. And you get a lot of, some people equate dinosaurs with 3-year-old kids who get really excited about monsters. And That's really, that is a component of it, and that's nice, but I wasn't that kid, honestly. I never got into this because I loved dinosaurs and just wanted to, I'm sassy about dinosaurs. I just thought evolution was really interesting, and I thought that the kinds of questions that we can answer using the fossil record are so unique, and you just get this perspective that you cannot get elsewhere if you only look at something that is alive today. So another example is when you study genetics, mm-hmm. when people study genetic evolution, genetic code is like the code behind your video game. Mm-hmm. This is something that my lab mate said yesterday. I don't want to take credit for all of these metaphors, but the code, the genetic code is the code that's driving your video game. But when you're playing the video game, you're interacting with the actual interface. Mm-hmm. You're not writing the code. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the same in evolution, right? Phenotypic traits or physical traits are the units of evolution. That's what's being acted on by natural selection. The genetic code is also changing, but it's important to understand the connection between the phenotype, so the physical manifestation of the trait, and the genetics behind it.
Yeah, because evolution doesn't act on genes, it acts on the traits.
Exactly.
Which change the genes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, and what would you say is your favorite part of your job?
So I am still a PhD student. I love getting excited about new projects and new scientific questions. Sometimes I take on more than I should. But I love getting to spend time around the specimens here in the collections. I think that being in a museum rather than just a department building in the university gives us an advantage of being around all the museum excitement, and we get to hear about exhibit openings and the behind-the-scenes research of other ROM employees or other grad students or professors, which I kind of talked about before. And we get to do public outreach, which I love doing here, and talking to other people. So it's a very special kind of environment to be in.
And what are some of the challenges of your job as a PhD student?
There are a number of things. There's obviously imposter syndrome, which I'm sure people have talked about on your podcast before. It's really easy to feel like other people know so much more than you do. Recently, I've started to feel a little bit more confident in my level of knowledge because I finished some parts of my project and I've been presenting it in front of people, and people have been responding really well to it. So that has given me some more confidence. But then there will always be someone who knows your method more than you. There will always be someone who knows your study organism or the system more than you. And I'm just teaching myself to become comfortable with not knowing things and always feeling okay asking those questions, because I always have questions and I often feel stupid asking them. But people almost always appreciate when you do ask them. My one piece of advice for anyone would be to always ask questions, no matter how stupid you feel that they are. Another thing is that's kind of a blessing and a curse is that I kind of decide my own hours. So I can come in as late as I want in the morning and then leave whenever I want. But, you know, I do have to get a certain amount of work done. And often I feel guilty if I have to leave at a certain time. And disconnecting like your work brain and your outside of work brain is really hard sometimes. So sometimes I like just have to go do something that isn't work, and I'm just thinking like, oh, I really should be working now. Like I really can't stop feeling guilty about how I'm not working right now. And that's tough when you're a PhD student and you don't have set hours. But it is nice that I get to decide when I come in and all that. And when I come in late, I stay late, just because I want to feel satisfied with the amount of work that I've been doing. But it's finding the correct balance, which I don't know if I've mastered yet.
Yeah. But it takes some time.
It definitely takes time.
Yeah, definitely important to like set aside self-care. Like, I cannot work today, or I cannot work this afternoon.
Well, so absolutely. But something that I think is underrated is a big component of self-care, at least for me, it doesn't work for everyone, is getting work done.
Yeah.
Just like, I chose a PhD, I chose this, I know that it's a lot of work. Sometimes to like reduce the anxiety, I need to get work done. And that is self-care too. And so recognizing when I actually just have to do that and say no to other things is really important too. So yeah, I if I work too much, I feel super run down and I need to make time for other things. But it's sometimes I take too much of a break and then I'm like, oh, I just really need to get back to work and get this thing done.
Yeah.
So yeah, all about balance.
Yeah, gotta find that balance, and I feel like it's always a work in progress.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think even people who are professors have it down, so.
And what advice do you have for young aspiring scientists out there?
Something about natural sciences that I do want to highlight to people is that it won't always be the glamorous Instagram, spending time in nature, field work. You know, you hear a lot about doing natural science and conservation, and you see people who are working with marine biology and diving underwater and doing really fun looking things. And field work is super fun.
Yeah.
The field work that I do is going, and we do dinosaur digs. So we go to Alberta and we dig for dinosaur bones, and it's really cool and it looks really cool.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, but it looks really cool. And then some bird work where you catch birds and you measure them and you get to hold birds. That's really exciting. And I feel like I worry that some people are drawn into it for the glamour of the
yeah.
fun being in nature. I love being in nature, but so much of science is just sitting in front of your computer and being frustrated with statistical models
yeah.
or writing a paper. And I just want to remind people who are in their undergrad that they should remember how much work goes into stuff. And it's not just sunshine and rainbows
yeah.
all the time, you know? There's it's always going to be hard work
yeah.
sitting at your computer and boring sometimes. It just sometimes might not be as exciting as you think it's going to be, but then you will have those fun moments where you get to go into the field and you get to play with bird specimens and you get to talk to people about your research. So there, you know, I would advise people to pay attention to the amount of work that goes into things in addition to the fun stuff. But other than that, if someone's in high school or middle school, do as much science as you can. Do science fairs, do competitions, just get research out there. Do whatever opportunities that you have. But if you're older and you want to go into science, it's also not too late. Like there's
yeah.
there's always opportunities, and science is fun.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Cool.
That's
yeah.
the main thing. I don't know if that was useful.
Yeah. I definitely feel called out on the glamorous fieldwork aspiration thing.
Yeah.
I've definitely, in considering a PhD, I was like, maybe it'd be really cool to do fieldwork. That seems exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I want to travel. I want to be
exactly.
outside. I want an active job. Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to sit in an office only, but there's no, you know, perfect
mm-hmm.
glamorous life. It's a lot of, you know, even if you're doing fieldwork, you know, 6 months of the year or 8 months of the year, you're probably at
probably
your
not that much.
Yeah. You're probably mostly at your computer, I mean. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It is easy to get sucked into that. And I think most people don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to draw people into science. We should draw more people into science.
Yeah.
And say, look how fun and cool it is.
Yeah.
Look, we get to be outside.
Yeah.
We get to travel to exotic places and see exotic things. It's so cool. And yeah, absolutely it is. But that's like 2 months of your year at most, maybe four. It depends what project
yeah.
you're working on. The rest of the time, you're at a computer and you're working on that data. And sometimes you just grow to hate your beautiful exotic organisms that you're working on.
That was it for the interview. Now let's step into the cavernous archives of the ROM and check out bird skeletons, eggs, and other historic artifacts that aren't shown to the general public. Oh, this is so exciting. Let's take a look.
It's my favorite room, because
it's there are birds hanging
yeah.
from the ceiling.
So yeah, you walk in and there's bird mounts, and then there's some birds hanging from the ceiling, some skeletons and skins, which are pretty awesome. Over in this cabinet, there are the eggs, and I don't really work on eggs at all.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty cool to look at anyway, because there's so many different
kinds of bird eggs.
Whoa.
And they're just like different colors and sizes.
These robin they're eggs are blue? Robin eggs. I got it.
And these are some nests in our collections. And some of these eggs are huge.
Whoa. What?
Yeah, this is, I think this might be a fossil. Let me look. Yeah. So it's from Madagascar. It's Apiornis maximus, which is, so it's a cast of an egg. So it's a fossil. I wonder if that's like an elephant bird or something.
Like,
yeah, so it's an extinct large ratite bird, which is, ratites are the groups of birds that have like emus and ostriches and tinamous, I always say that.
They were that big.
Yeah. Yeah, they were, some of them were just really massive. Bigger than the ones that are alive today.
After gushing over eggs for a bit, we took a look at the bird collections.
So these are categorized by their group. So there's ducks in here, falcons. There's like three big hallways of this.
Wow.
I can open up one of them and show you.
Yeah. And you can come in and like use this for your research if it's relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. So I sometimes will pull a box out so I can look at it. So this is Falco sparvarius sparvarius. And the label on the box, it tells us the specimen number and the sex and whether it's an immature or adult. So this one says female immature. The date that it was collected and then where it's collected from. So this is Toronto, Ossington, at Harbour Street, which is surprising. So Falco sparvarius is a kestrel, which is a really cute little falcon. If you want to look up a picture of a kestrel. So this one looks kind of gross. Still has some fat on it, but it's kind of greasy. But you get the whole skeleton in this box. So people are probably wondering how we get the skeleton.
Yeah.
We have a bug room. So we have a room of dermestid beetles, and what they do is they eat rotting flesh. So you essentially get the dead animal. I think you have to skin it first. So you get rid of the skin and like the fur or feathers, depending on what it is. You stick it in there overnight, and they just eat off all the flesh. And they clean it better than a human can.
Oh like, my goodness. I just thought that a human took like scissors and scrubbing and soap.
Yeah.
And
yeah, so maybe afterwards people could do that, but the beetles do it better than any human can.
Wow.
I'll show you some of the really, really tiny birds. And you'll, like, they're so small and their bones are so thin, a person would just break it.
Yeah.
Right? So these are hummingbirds. That's a really
the
good
tiniest example of birds.
Yeah, so let's see.
Their eggs are also, like, breath mint sized.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I've ever seen a hummingbird egg. Oh, this is a really good example.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you see how tiny this is. It's just, like, sometimes I just freak out at how cute they are. You're just holding a tiny leg bone. Okay, so I mentioned earlier the furcula, right? The fused clavicles.
Yeah.
So you've ever like eaten chicken and there's a wishbone?
There's a wishbone.
So that's that of the hummingbird.
Is that what the bend is? Like in turkeys and Thanksgiving? Like it's the wishbone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They look different in different birds. So this one's kind of broken actually, but that's what the sternum looks like. It's got a huge keel because they hover and they fly continuously.
Yeah.
And there's a teeny tiny skull.
Oh my gosh, it's so small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually think that there might be some that are even smaller than this. This is not the smallest one that I've seen. This is
so cool.
This is the lower jaw, and this is the... Okay,
oh
maybe
my
I'll hold it in a way that you can see it, but it's so tiny.
It's so... I didn't process that that was all bone. Like, their long, long mouth is all...
Yeah, so they do have a beak covering the bone, but...
And the beak is made of different materials?
Yeah, so the beak is made of keratin, which is the same thing that your hair and nails are made from.
Goodness.
So that...
A tiny rib cage.
Yeah, so this is a tiny rib cage, tiny sternum, vertebrae. It's so small.
The sternum is pretty big.
Like, it's pretty big. They have bigger sternum size relative to their body size. Actually, maybe we'll just leave it in there.
Yeah, I don't know how you can get it. Half their body.
And so this...
Oh my gosh.
So I think this is its tongue.
Yeah.
So I think it has like a bony support for its tongue because it's got this super long beak.
Oh my goodness.
So it's got the long beak to go into flowers and drink nectar. So it has this tongue.
that goes in as well.
Whoa.
Yeah. So woodpeckers also have a really long tongue that actually wrap around their head.
So there's like grooves in their skull, and the tongue comes from their mouth and then like around behind their jaw and connects up onto the top of their head. So if you ever get to dissect a woodpecker, you know, as one does, which I have done, you can like pull out the tongue and you'll see on the skull where it moves. It kind of like pulls it forward and it goes backwards on the skull. Pretty weird.
Whoa. I heard someone told me that's to prevent like impact when they're pecking.
That makes sense. Yeah, that does make sense. What else do I want to show you? Some of these mounts are really, really pretty. So I talked about the kestrel before. I showed you the kestrel.
Yes.
This is the kestrel, and they're so cute because they're these tiny falcons.
They're real cute here.
Yeah, and this is so it's got like a little house sparrow as its prey.
Yes, and the house sparrows are also invasive.
And they're
like,
everywhere.
There are like old world sparrows. So many birds are invasive. So
bees aren't native to North America.
Honeybees aren't.
Honeybees.
Yeah, there are a lot of bees that are.
There are.
But honeybees aren't. This is my favorite duck. This is a wood duck. And you can see these in Hyde Park and different parks in Toronto, and they're so pretty.
They are so pretty. Ducks have really, really beautiful heads.
That one especially does, the wood duck. So yeah, you can look up and see some cool things.
Wow. And a lot of these specimens were found from, like, birds that died.
Yeah, yeah. So it'll say on the label, roadkill, or whatever. Someone hit a window. We get a lot of window collisions.
Yeah.
So there's this organization called FLAP, which stands for something I cannot remember.
Yes.
But they go out early in the mornings, and they collect birds that have crashed into buildings in Toronto, and they're donated to the museum. And it's, you know, really important for buildings to understand that that's happening. And it's important to turn off lights at night because the lights can confuse them. You've probably seen some windows in buildings that have the silhouettes of birds.
Yeah.
That's to try to prevent collisions into buildings, but it'll probably happen no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had someone, I did a video on bird collisions. And
oh, really?
Yeah, and someone was like, I've never seen dead birds. I don't think this is that big of a problem.
Because they go out at 4 a.m. to collect the dead birds.
Yeah.
Talia is talking about FLAP, F-L-A-P, or the Fatal Light Awareness Program. Every morning, volunteers hit the streets of Toronto to look for migratory birds that might have been injured, stunned, or killed in collisions with glass buildings and windows, and they clean them up and often donate them to places like the ROM. As a volunteer, I spend a lot of my time holding small taxidermied animals in my hand and showing them to kids. And the thing they always ask, most often, more often than anything, is, did you kill this? Why is it dead? How did it die? Do you kill animals? And the answer is no. Maybe decades ago, you know, museum collectors would go and kill animals to put them in their museums, but that is no longer allowed. So a lot of our animals and other skins come from donations for animals that have already been found dead. We spend some time marveling over the old collections, over a century of handwritten notes on eggs, birds, habitats, and more. We found old compasses, ancient file cabinets. Wow. Talia had just a couple of more birds to point out.
Cygnus. Swan?
That's a swan, yeah, Cygnus. They're pretty cool.
Very cool. I guess they must be bigger, like bigger.
Yeah, do you want to see?
Oh, sure.
So Cygnus olor is the mute swan, I think. These are other species of swans. So Cygnus columbianus.
There's some big boxes here.
So this one says, for example, Canada, Ontario, Thunder Bay. I guess it doesn't say, like, exactly how it was found, but this one says it's from Point Pelee, which is a huge birding migration hotspot.
Yes.
What I find very, very fun is just, like, the bones that are so tiny in hummingbirds and so big in swans, they're the same bones.
Yeah.
They've just been reduced or enlarged so much, and it's just
crazy to
me. Is this, what is this?
So that's the sternum. So this is the trachea. And the trachea is the tube that leads to, I can't remember.
It's the windpipe, right?
Yeah, don't use this because I don't remember. This is a bird. Yeah,
that's okay.
I think it is the windpipe and it leads to the syrinx. Nope. The syrinx, which is their voice box. They've got, humans use a larynx, but birds have a syrinx, and that is what they use to make sound.
This is a kiwi.
Yeah.
And kiwis are flightless. Right?
Yeah.
So what does that say about the bones? So the sternum is flat, right? Wow. There's no keel in the sternum. It's really tiny.
Yeah.
And also look at its wings. Look, it's tiny wings.
Where are they?
They're right here.
Oh my goodness. Isn't
that so funny?
They're teeny
tiny.
Like
at first glance, like, oh, it's just a bird. Like, you know.
Its wings are like 1/10 the size of its beak.
Absolutely. If you compare the wings to the legs.
Yeah.
That's
ridiculous. So it's a bird that runs a lot.
Definitely. Because it, I don't know if it runs fast, but it definitely has more investment in its hind limbs than its forelimbs because it's not a flying bird.
Can you let people know where they can find you on the internet, on social media?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at TaliaMLM, and I'm on Instagram at TaliaLM. So I post about my birds and my science, and people can see that. I'm also doing this event called Soapbox Science Toronto.
Exciting.
You might have heard of it. Soapbox Science is a global event where in different cities, women in STEM basically stand in a public place and talk about their science to members of the public. And it's a really great outreach initiative for visibility in science, visibility of women in science. And so I'm doing the Toronto event in September. I don't know the exact date yet, but keep your eyes open for that if anybody is in Toronto and wants to learn about some science.
That is amazing. I love that event. I went last year to watch it.
Oh, it's great.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll be talking about birds and dinosaurs and getting kids excited about it, adults, everyone.
Everyone, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Awesome. And that's all the questions I had. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for today's episode. Birds, am I right? Warm-blooded, evolved from reptiles, have pecs so strong that they have an extra large sternum bone to hold them together. Huge shout out for Talia for sharing her knowledge with you and me. Wasn't she the coolest? This summer, she did an actual real-life dino dig. It looked incredible, and you can follow along on her socials, which I've linked, as always, in the show notes. To keep the conversation going, follow the podcast at ScienceSucksPod on Twitter. Rate and review us on iTunes so other folks can find the show. I'm Evie. Check out some birds in your area and have an amazing week.